Patris, Filii, et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Ave Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum, benedicta tu in mulieribus, et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Iesus.
Sancta Maria, Mater Dei, ora pro nobis peccatoribus, nunc et in hora mortis nostre. Amen.
Nomine Patris, Filii, Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Brother in Christ, laudato Jesus Christus.
In saecula.
In saecula.
This is Timothy Flanders with the meaning of Catholic Jesus is King. You're watching and or listening to the Terror of Demons morning show with the author, Kennedy Hall, and co-host, the Paleocrat. How you doing, brethren?
Doing good, man.
Excellent. Living the dream in Canada. I assume, Kennedy?
In Trudopia.
Trudopia, how's your new place? Working out
it's
well?
Wonderful. Yeah, it's wonderful. It's a little slice of heaven out here. I'm really glad we got out of the city.
Fantastic. You probably have a nice starscape, right?
We do. We have...
That must be awesome.
We do have some street lights, but there's no, like... They're just because it's a highway stuff near us, but there's no city lights or anything, so it's pretty good at night.
Awesome. Sweet. Mm-hmm. Well, today's topic is, can a Catholic be a libertarian? And we are presenting contrary views on that question today. Welcome to the last week after Pentecost. It's an exciting week. Last week after Pentecost. Advent begins next week. It's never too late to jump into the St. Martin's fast or to make Advent penitential again. Do some penance, fasting, abstinence. Cold showers, whatever. Yeah, definitely get cold showers if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. That's good. Today is the Feast of St. Cecilia, patroness of music. Tomorrow's St. Clement. We have the Vietnamese martyrs on Wednesday, St. Andrew Dunlop and companions. St. Catherine of Alexandria. She was a early philosopher in Alexandria. She was actually taken off of the Novus Ordo calendar, and then John Paul II put her back on the Novus calendar. St. Sylvester on Friday, and Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal before we dive into the first Sunday of Advent. It's an exciting time. So tomorrow on Meaning of Catholic, we actually have Michael Lofton coming back on the show. We're going to talk about his dissertation. He's doing a dissertation on magisterial reversals. So it's a very interesting topic and apropos as well. So we're talking to Lofton tomorrow, and then we'll have English Soul Part 2 with Vonday Radio on Friday. That's what's happened with Meaning of Catholic. Kennedy, what's happening with the Kennedy profession?
Oh, well, I have to look at the headlines because it's big news week of everything we talked about.
Yeah, there is quite a big news last week, isn't there?
Friday. And so we're going to see if there's any developments there. I imagine the regime will retaliate in some way, even if it's indirect. So we'll see what's happening there. And then it's Thanksgiving this week for you guys. So we don't have live broadcast Thursday or Friday. Actually, this week, though, too, for LifeSite, I'm going to interview Dr. Julie Panessi. Have you seen her videos that went viral? Like, she was the professor from the university who did that little 4.5-minute ethics thing. She was an ethics professor that got fired for saying that it was unethical to coerce people into taking medication that they don't want to take. And she's a wonderful woman. She's I think she has a background in ancient philosophy. I have no idea what she believes about Christianity or anything, but she's just very sound in the natural law. So she makes really salient points. And I'm going to interview her with LifeSite, which I'm really excited about.
Sweet. That'll be great. Yeah. I know they're already canceling people on Twitter who agree with the verdict. So
yes, I wrote the article for LifeSite on it. So I hope they don't cancel.
There we go.
You're done, buddy.
One of our patrons was permanently banned from Twitter because he said something like, the verdict was correct, or like Rittenhouse didn't do anything wrong or something. That was the verdict, right?
There are people out there, like, and I mean this, I was talking to a family member yesterday and they said, did you hear what happened in the States? They have no idea what I do for a living. I don't know. And I said, yeah, sure. What happened in the States? And they said, well, this kid, you know, he was going around carrying a gun. He shot a black man. And I'm just like, what? I do believe, but every once in a while, like, I'm not in the Matrix anymore because, you know, we all been red pilled. But when I am around people that are back in it and they say things, it shocks me. Like, it shocks me to my core. Like, I get shook. You know, I'm thinking, ooh, like, I got to chill. I don't know what that's like to live in a world where And if the person's not, I told them the truth and they went, oh, I had heard totally different. Yeah. I'm thinking, oh my goodness gracious. That's what people believe.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeremiah, what's happening with the Paleocrat Diaries? We got Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Tune in.
I know, man. Well, it's not just that. It's the Wolfpack chat. Like, people say, what's going on with Paleocrat Diaries? And I'm like, it never stops. it's constant. Like, every day is like 700 comments. But no, we're having a good old time. Today, we're continuing the series on how not to be secular, which is a book by, in fact, it's a professor at Calvin College that wrote a book that is kind of the cliff notes to a book written by a Catholic philosopher on the secular age. So it's kind of an interesting take, and I have differences with both of them. So it's kind of fun to go through that. We're on part three. And then on Wednesday and Friday, we're continuing our series at Meaning of Catholic on Father LaSance. And so I'm not entirely sure, because I'm not going chapter by chapter, but I will say this. Once I'm done with Father LaSance, once I'm done with that, I'm going to continue in the same vein as we were with Enthusiasm, but I'm going to try to pick up where Ronald Knox left off, because I think that it's just gone haywire since then. I think we're living in a time of great enthusiasms, maybe for even the last, 100 years or so, and even into cults and things like that. And so to continue that, to show how schism begets schism begets schism, and show sometimes even that the weirdness is in us, and that we may not even realize it, which is a theme of secular age. So, and then lastly, we've been doing a lot over at the Wolfpack chat. We have a book club that meets fortnightly, so every 2 weeks. And yesterday we had our second book club meeting. We're going through the book Interior Castle by St. Teresa of Avila. And so we're into the fifth mansion right now. That's what we're talking about. And then we do prayer meetings and stuff like that. So we have open prayer chat stuff, and we take people's prayer requests. I think our log is up to 80 something requests right now. And we keep a track of them, and we reach out to people to make sure, say, is this something you still want us to pray for? How did it work out? Are there any additional things, stuff like that? So if people have requests and everything, just find us over at Telegram. You can find me at Jeremiah Bannister or Paleocrat, as well as the Paleocrat Wolfpack Diaries, which is just at at the Wolfpack chat. And it has all the information right there in the dropdown to connect with those different things that we do.
So yeah, it's a great community over at the Wolfpack. You can join the Kennedy profession at the link below. Join Kennedy's show every day, and also the Paleocrat Patreon is linked below as well. Support Jeremiah and Jeremiah's kids going to Catholic school. So finally, the new book is released, City of God versus City of Man. If you want more details as to the critique of libertarianism from a historical perspective, it's contained in this book. And we also have the Meaning of Catholic Guild, which is growing, which is an online community designed to economically support one another in the era of the Marxist COVID regime. So we're currently building contacts to network with people in the United States and Canada for people who need to migrate, people who need to change their economic situation, various things like that. So let's get into our topic. Can a Catholic be a libertarian? I'll make one point, and then I'll let Kennedy respond to it. And then Paleocrat's got a lot of insights about the state and government. First of all, let me say, if you want an introduction to this topic, I would recommend, I don't have the book, I left it in the other room, but Thomas Woods Jr., The Church and the Market, is a modern, more classical text that you can read, which is where he's translating these two gentlemen, Rothbard and Mises. They're the sort of the Austrian godfathers, and he's translated it into a Catholic point of view. So you got Thomas Woods Jr., Church and the Market. Then you can read Ferrara, Church and the Libertarian. That one is a response to Woods, that's critiquing Woods. And then you can read Christ, Capital, and Liberty, which is a response to Ferrara. So it's this little back and forth that happened in the past 20 years or so. That so it's very recent. These people are still living. So it's a good back and forth there to try to get deeper into the topic. But my I think, in my opinion, I think that libertarian economics has a lot of good insights into market analysis and things like that. And I think there's a lot of its emphasis on the making the market free from government coercion. It has a good critique of big government. Its emphasis on entrepreneurship to alleviate poverty. Those are all the good things that I see in libertarian economics. But I think that it makes fatal problems in its very premises. And to prove that, I'm going to read from Anthony Flood here. So this is actually a libertarian defending critiques. Okay, so this is from a pro-libertarian source. And this is an example of the critical errors that are made by Rothbard and Mises. This is on page 282. He says this. In my opinion, Murray's agnosticism about God's existence and revelation produced a defective anthropology, and one's view of man cannot help but affect every branch of one's theory. So Rothbard starts with the premise that he's agnostic about God's existence. Therefore, he comes to a wrong conclusion about the nature of man, which then, if you have a wrong conclusion about the nature of man, then it leads to problems in every other aspect of your theory, even according to this Rothbardian. Flood continues, one terrible consequence of this is to regard the human fetus as the mother's property, which, merely upon the change of location from in utero to ex utero, becomes a potential bearer of absolute rights. According to Murray's reasoning, the right to procure an abortion, that is, the absolute right to have the human being whose genetically distinct body naturally came from inside her, is killed. His anthropology made the individual, rather than the family, the starting point for social theorizing. So right there, we have an error in the very fundamental premise of the nature of man, leading to the advocacy that child murder is okay in the utero. And then Flood admits that Rothbard, the godfather of Austrian economics, says the individual rather than the family is the starting point for the social theorizing. So the whole social theory of libertarian economics is based on the wrong foundation in the first place. So not only are we denying or just sort of being ignorant of man's existence or God's existence so that we have a wrong nature of man, we also start with the individual as the irreducible social unit of the society instead of the family. So the Catholic economics starts with the family and says the family is the social unit upon which we construct our whole economic theory, not the individual. So my first critique here is there's a misunderstanding of man's nature. There's a misunderstanding of the family being the social unit. And that leads to all these errors, such as the advocacy of child murder. That's what I got. Go ahead, Kennedy.
I think we're jumping the gun a little bit here, saying that one of the philosophers of libertarianism advocate or was apathetic towards abortion. That would be like saying we should throw out Aristotelianism because there was pederasty in the Greek philosophers. With all due respect, we'd have to throw out all of antiquity, and we'd have to throw out basically every pagan philosopher because they all had weird moral points at some point. I would also say that Rothbard is not the godfather of Austrian economics. He's not Austrian. It would be Hayek and it would be Mises, essentially, for the most part. Rothbard is one of the libertarian thinkers. And the thing about libertarianism is that the spirit of the libertarians is very libertarian in that they don't associate any single theoretician or philosopher with having some sort of dogmatic authority over what they ought to believe about various things. So, for example, today, libertarianism is kind of bifurcated into what I'll call serious libertarians and unserious libertarians, libertarians, LOL libertarians, and libertarians. So on the serious side of things, you have folks like Tom Woods, irrespective of what people may think about man's personal life. There are many people in Catholic apologetics who have personal lives that we shouldn't reveal. That's not our business. But there are serious thinkers like Jeffrey Tucker and Tom Woods from actual Catholic side. You may not agree with everything they've ever said, but they're serious is what I'm saying. You know, they're serious on their morals. They're pro-life. And even, I'm not American, so I couldn't vote for the Libertarian Party if I tried, and I wouldn't want to because it's kind of cringe. However, I remember watching candidates or whatever on a podcast when the first time Trump was running, you know, 2016 or something. And he basically said, you know, libertarians easily can advocate for the pro-life position because Rothbard was writing in the early 1970s, and there's been a great advance in science since the 1970s. So many agnostics on the pro-choice issue had changed their minds with the advent of fetology. That's the whole Abby Johnson story. When Rothbard was writing, that was before Bernard Nathanson, for example, had his major conversion. If you know him, he was the abortion doctor who was an agnostic Jew who died a faithful Catholic, thanks be to God. But his clinic was in charge of 60,000 abortions, I believe. He actually performed, I think, two abortions on two of his girlfriends. It was a very dark past. But what changed for him is, as a doctor, is he actually saw the ultrasound and went, oh no, I was wrong. And that's actually, if you read Rothbard's treatise in For New Liberty on abortion, he actually contends with the Catholic position. And he says the Catholic position is not, I'm paraphrasing, but it's not unserious. And he says, if it is murder, then it's clearly wrong. But he was not convinced that it was, because he wasn't convinced of the development of the human person at that early of a stage. He was wrong about that, just like Plato was wrong about pederasty. But Platonic philosophy still works, and it has various things. Now, as far as the critique of Rothbard saying it begins with the individual, I would go even further back. If you read everyone, to in my opinion, to have a true critique of libertarian Austrian economics. Okay, because that is the kicker when it comes to the economic side. You got to read Human Action, which is a very dense read for a lot of people, but you have to read it. I'm reading through it right now, and it's like reading, and I don't mean this to conflate Mises with a pope, but I'm saying the style, because he's German, is like reading Ratzinger. It's got that same Germanic cadence to it. So when you're reading it, it's very dense. You read it and you have to put it down for a while, and you got to pick it up. Just like when I remember reading Jesus of Nazareth from Ratzinger, and it's, you can't read that fast, you know? And, what the crux of Austrian economics, the reason why it starts with the individual, as far as the transactional nature of it goes, is because of the free will of people to make decisions about what to do with their transactions. Okay. And that can be immediate currencies, like trading a stick for another stick, which is the most basic and primordial. It can be with mediums, like using currency and so on and so forth. It's not about what the person does with their money. It's about the fact that people do act and do things for economic reasons. And that's the science behind it. I will liken it, to Viktor Frankl, who I know, Tim, that you've said you believe is a logos psychologist. And one of the things that we talked about in our Telegram chat is, you said, well, there's no acknowledgement of original sin in the thinking of the Austrian economists, so you have to contend with that. Well, there was no acknowledgement of original sin in the truest sense in Aristotle, because it wasn't a dogma that he understood. There was no acknowledgement of original sin in Plato. There was no acknowledgement of original sin in Viktor Frankl. Viktor Frankl was clearly a great psychologist, and you've admitted this before as well, Tim. The reality is that, just as St. Paul says in Romans chapter 2, verse 15, I believe, the natural law is written on all our hearts. A smart person can understand how man works, because that's how God has ordained it. Hence why a smart person without revelation can reason to the existence of God. All of these things are possible without understanding the dogmas of the Catholic Church. So when it's in the realm of scientific fact, not scientific in the popular sense of scientism in our day, I mean, everything's science, but in the sense of knowing how things work. Someone who's in state of mortal sin could be a great physicist. Someone who's in state of mortal sin could actually be a great psychologist. If what we mean is they're starting at the root of, like Viktor Frankl would, for example, those who were in the concentration camps were able to survive if they had a purpose. That's as far as he went. He didn't say what that purpose had to be, but that was just an objective fact of human nature. And that's how it worked. Now, as Catholics, we have to listen to our theologians and moral theologians and popes and so forth, and so far as we have to listen to them, as, you know, dogma is concerned. So we have to have an end for our action that is consistent with the faith. But the fact that people act towards an end and make their decisions based on that is a universal of human nature. So, for example, if Viktor Frankl would say, if somebody is, I'm extrapolating from Viktor Frankl's psychology for a second, who was not Catholic, who did not believe in original sin because he wasn't Catholic. He might have had some wrong conceptions about man because he wasn't Catholic, but there you go. He was still right on psychology. So he would say, for example, you know, if someone was in a state of despair, they have to have a purpose in order to get out of a state of despair. That purpose could be as simple as he wants to make little figurines out of dried apples. And he gets up every morning to make little figurines out of dried apples. His state of psychological health will objectively improve over time if he does that. This is no different than virtue ethics, which is a logos-based ethics. With Aristotle, if we go back to this idea of virtue ethics, which has been reversed in pop psychology, which, Tim, you've rightly criticized. Today, the emphasis on ethics is get yourself feeling right, and then you'll act right. But we actually know what precedes that. And you and I have talked about this, Jeremiah, with dealing with depression and things. Get yourself acting right, and then your feelings will follow. It doesn't matter what the intent is, necessarily, beyond the basic needs of feeling better for someone to act properly. Someone could be a total atheist. Someone could be a complete Hindu, can be whatever. They could be a total polyamorous hedonist. But if they're dealing with bipolar or something, if they make the conscious decision based on the basic human reality of being unsatisfied and even going from that to satisfaction, which is a basic universal, and they say, I'm going to get up at 7 a.m, I'm going to walk my dog, and I'm going to have a smoothie every morning, and I'm going to sit down and read my favorite Hardy Boys novel series for 20 minutes because that makes me happy. If they do that, they will objectively become a happier and more thriving person, and the degrees will follow therefrom. What they end up doing after that is a matter of morals, religion, and so on and so forth, which we know what you have to do to be saved. But these are basic human universals. That's what Mises starts with. And he says, we now have 2,000 years or 3,500 years roughly of economic history. And economics has largely changed because of currencies and resources and globalism and transport and all these sorts of things have vastly made the situation more complex. So he said, we have to look at the basis and say, why does man act economically and what does he do? There's the basis for our science. What people do with that is up to them.
Yeah. I can't hear you at all, Tim.
It was such a great point. I mean, what we're dealing with is, Kennedy, you're saying that we can take pre-Christian philosophers and compare them to post-Christian philosophers. And to a degree, I think you're right, because anyone who has reason who can observe things. And as I said, I concede a great deal to the libertarians. I think that there's a lot of great economic analysis that can be drawn from this. But I think that when we want to, you know, taking Viktor Frankl saying, well, you need to have a meaning to live. I'm not going to create an entire social and economic theory of the whole people and the state based on someone's lack of understanding of these basic things. The other aspect of this is the science has been debated among the best economists for centuries about all these different theories. So it is not scientific, not any sort of consensus among economists on these points. But let Jeremiah get in here. Go ahead.
Well, first I wanted to say real quick, you mentioned earlier Farrar's book, Church and Libertarianism. I think I was the first person to interview him about that. And my interviews with him, the audio is kind of garbage because it's back. It was a while ago. It was like 2010 or whatever. But my videos the audios that are made available on YouTube, I believe they're all still there. I don't know if they're all public. If they're not, if people want to go and check it out and they see that maybe not all of them are, I think it's 5 parts. Let me know and I'll make sure to provide those to you. So, but it was an excellent interview with him on that. I interviewed him while I was still with the Distributist Review. One of the things that, you know, whenever I hear this conversation, for one, you know, there, it may be true, you know, Aristotle and Plato, they were wrong about this or that, and we still can recognize them. They were not 2,000 years after Jesus was here. Like, I mean, I don't mean to be mean about that. I mean, they're obviously not going to say much about Jesus. They wouldn't, for example, they wouldn't be able to say certain things about Jesus that Mises did. Talking about comparing him to a Bolshevik, for example, right? Saying that Christianity, the early Christianity, Right here, he says, let's see. Jesus's words are full of resentment against the rich, and the apostles are no meeker in this respect. The rich man is condemned because he's rich. The beggar praised because he's poor. In God's kingdom, the poor shall be rich, but the rich shall be made to suffer. Later revisers have tried to soften the words of Christ against the rich, but there's quite enough left to support those who incite the world to hatred of the rich, revenge, murder, and arson. This is a case in which the Redeemer's words bore evil seed. More harm has been done and more blood shed on account of them than by the persecution of heretics and the burning of witches. They've always rendered the church defenseless against all movements which aim to destroy human society. The church as an organization has certainly always stood on the side of those who tried to ward off communistic attack, but it was continually disarmed by the words, "Blessed be the poor, for yours is the kingdom of God." And I sit there and I say, that's a guy in Germany who had been saturated with Christianity all around him. Like, I mean, there's no lack of Bibles. There's no lack of theological training and books. He's just like intellectually reprobate. Like, this guy, he wants nothing to do with even the idea that he came up with that from any remotely reliable source. And so to sit there and say, how can somebody 2000 years after Jesus was around be so offensively wrong? So brazenly wrong, and to have that published in a book, for crying out loud, you know, I mean, I wonder who he had, you know, look it up and.
Sorry, but these aren't arguments against whether libertarianism works as an economic philosophy. Well, no, this is about the man's religiosity.
Well, no, what I'm saying is that you can't keep going back and comparing him to Aristotle and Plato, because he's around 2000. There's a significant difference between somebody whose presuppositions weren't Christian before Christianity and somebody whose presuppositions are anti-Christian 2000 years after Christianity, coming from the culture that is robustly Christian, whether or not we want to say Catholic or not. So it's a facade, I feel, to use that. I think it's a trick in a way. I'm not saying you're trying to trick. I'm saying it's a trick for a lot of the people who would listen and say, oh, it's apples and apples. And I'm like, no, it's not. It might not even be in the same field of fruit. I would go further than that, though. I'd say they're presuppositionally incorrect. Like, and if you're presuppositionally incorrect, if you're starting off with the most basic, your assumptions are wrong from the get-go, and you're saying your assumptions about the individual are wrong, then if your entire philosophy is based off of an individual's actions and an individual's reasons, then insofar as you're ever right, it's accidentally. It's incidentally.
What is wrong about their presuppositions about the individual?
Their anthropology would not be, insofar as it does not reflect Catholic anthropology, it's wrong.
How does it not reflect Catholic anthropology and its basic understanding of what a man is?
Well, this is where it gets in difficult weeds, I think, with you, because you can bring up popes who talk about moral theology and Catholic anthropology, and you could say, well, you know, the popes have been wrong.
I'm not saying that. I'm asking what
you did last episode.
No, I didn't say they're wrong about anthropology, and I didn't say they're wrong about morals. I said they could be wrong about economics.
But I talked for a long time. Hold on a second. So what I said last show is I said, and I quoted, I said, the popes have said that economic theory and that what they say, the social and cyclical tradition, is not under general ideas or ideals, espoused ideals, but that it is under the realm of moral theology. And I said, that's why the popes say they have that. And I said, you would be forced into a position where you'd have to deny it. So I said, if the popes say that what they're talking about when they talk about the economy, when they talk about the political economy, when they say those things and they say we have competence, we have authority and jurisdiction because it's under the realm of moral theology, then I'm at full right to to say that and say, look, insofar as when they talk about individualism and in what they say about individualism as a starting point, and again, the shipwreck right here, accordingly, twin rocks of shipwreck must be carefully avoided, for as one is wrecked upon or comes close to what is known as individualism, by denying or minimizing the social and public character of the right of property, so by rejecting or minimizing the private and individual character of this same right, one inevitably runs into collectivism, or they get close to its tenet. And it says, unless one keeps it in mind, one is swept up from his course upon the shoals of that moral, juridical, and social modernism which we denounced in the encyclical issued at the beginning of our pontificate. So they're again, collectivism and individualism. And they're saying, if you start out with that, you are, that's the rock of shipwreck right there. And what we're talking about here, that's their presupposition.
Whose presupposition?
Mises and Rothbard.
How is Mises' presupposition individualism as such?
It's a starting point. He doesn't start with family. He doesn't start with the Trinity. So he's not starting with a group, one and a many. Mm-hmm. He's starting with the idea of the individual, which is why anarcho-capitalism is better suited maybe for him. And to say it's really about the individual and an individual's right. And insofar as it moves beyond that is only insofar as an individual may bump heads with somebody else, which where non-aggression principle would get involved.
So in the basis of Austrian economics, as far as where it starts for individual action,
yeah,
it's about the fact that people make decisions based on their free will themselves.
Individuals.
What do you make decisions with your wife's mind at the same time as your mind?
Do I make decisions at the same time?
Like you think as Jeremiah Bannister, right? You don't think as Mrs. Jeremiah Bannister.
Yeah.
So you act as an individual.
Yes.
Okay,
but I'm not the foundation of. But that fact is not the foundation of my social theory.
So at the beginning of human action,
he
lays out what the basis of praxeology is, which is the study of basically the science of why a man acts economically. Does it make a statement whether it should be that way? Does it make a statement about whether he should act for his family? Does it make a statement about if acting for himself is the proper way of thing to do? It's just the fact that he does. That's it. So again, this is a matter of recognizing the scientific reality of what happens with economic transactions. Now, I have to address the whole Pope thing. If we're talking about whether or not a Pope, of course the Pope has the jurisdiction to talk about a whole host of things. But there's a reason why we have the theological notes. There are many things that can be said in an encyclical or a letter from a bishop or whatever that are binding because those have been defined and are in the realm of debate when they haven't been defined. And if they pertain to matter, if they pertain to the application of morals combined with the understanding of a science, those things can change with further information on that science. This has happened many times in the church history. Again, I will bring up the example of creationism versus evolution. I don't believe in evolution at all. But the Pontifical Biblical Commission in 1907, I think it was, under Pius X, and at that time it was said that it had to be with the pain of sin and so forth, made it clear that you could look at the word yom metaphorically for day, and it doesn't necessarily, in a defined fashion, have to be 6,000 years. That's just the reality, because especially when you go to Christmas, was it Christmas, and they say that they use the whatever translation, it's 5,250 years before Christ. Anyway, it's a difference of 2,000-3,000 years, depending on the translation anyway, depending on which one you use in the liturgy. So there's a there's a level of discrepancy there that is permissible. There were popes in the past who didn't believe that, but Augustine gives us the principle for looking at scripture and saying we have to believe it literally unless reason tells us otherwise. Okay, now as far as though, as one more thing about popes as well. In the recent history, we have seen popes be wrong on matters of politics and social engagement, for example, which includes economics. This is the thing, you can't separate economics from any of it. This is the thing as well. Like, this is one thing that I've been realizing. A lot of people assume that the Austrians are. I'm not saying you're saying, but they assume that they're almost materialists or something because they're only concerned with the economics. It's actually the opposite. They're not materialists at all as far as economics goes as such. The materialists, and even in Mises, he criticizes classical economics. He calls the conclusions absurd. So that's Adam Smith et al. Because they try to separate your action and interaction in society from the economic decisions you make. And there's like the economic and the non-economic. It's not really possible. If I go for a walk in the middle of the day, I'm making an economic decision because I'm a freelance writer if I want to be, and I could write instead of work, or I could work instead of walk. That's an economic decision. And so I could turn more lights on. I mean, everything we do has to do with using resources and so on and so forth in some capacity. Now, I do have to address as well this idea that the individualism thing. I have to talk about that for a little more here, because the crux of the praxeological understanding of how a man acts economically is that he moves from a state of uneasiness, is the word that's used, to satisfaction. And that is, again, a basic universal of all the decisions that we make as we live in time and things change. Mm-hmm. So I act that way in a religious sense. I'm uneasy about my salvation because I'm working it out in fear and trembling. So I pray. In a sense, I make a transaction with God. And we use those words for like the economy of grace and so on and so forth. There's a reason why those words are used. As far as me working for my family, I make my decisions based on my circumstance. So if you're a single man and you have no children, you make a decision to act economically for some reason. You may make a decision to act economically for yourself because you're not interested in a spouse. You may make a decision to act economically to save up for a house because of the potential of having a spouse. When I have a family, by default, my circumstance requires me, unless I myself have some moral defect, which no system will change, I make the decision to act so that I can procure resources so that my family can be warm in the winter. I cannot separate them from my decisions because they're part of my reality. It's not individualism versus collectivism. It's individualism in the Ayn Randian sense. I don't believe in Ayn Rand stuff. But this basic scientific application of how a man acts economically is neither individualist nor collectivist. It's just a fact of how we act. And that's it. And you can use that to understand how to have a transactional market. That's it.
I should say, just as a disclaimer, kind of like I have a disclaimer at the beginning of my show, right? That my opinions sometimes are just my opinions and stuff like that. The only people who really say that Mises' understanding of praxeology is scientific are praxeologists.
Okay.
That's it. I mean, that's kind of like, you know, it's, I mean, in many ways, the way that they talk of themselves is kind of like Scientologists talking about thetans. That when Scientologists say, look, you know, I'm sick today and I'm holding on to this battery with these weird wires because I'm getting my thetan level.
We're getting into straw mans here by comparing.
No, I'm not. You've used the phrase that it's scientific numerous times. Mm-hmm. Any listener to this show might interpret that. Now, you were fair to say it's not like scientism. Well, that's a straw man in this sense, because it's not even like science, technically. It's science to them. It's science to them. But to many others, they would, in fact, to the vast majority of people who, let's say, they're not even people that you would say are scientistic people that just believe in genuine science in general. The vast overwhelming majority of them don't believe that that is scientific.
I didn't say natural science, by the way. I said science. So it's just about an order.
Well, okay. Okay. So yeah. So it's part of a body of knowledge that you say, okay, well, it's scientific in that sense. You go, well, yeah, but even then, the vast majority of the people in that realm, in that sphere that deal with that, even Christian people, overwhelming majority of Catholic, Christian or otherwise, all throughout history, do not believe that. And so when they talk of themselves, no, but what I'm saying is that it's one of those
things. Is that like climate change consensus?
No, what I'm saying is that people should at least be aware that there's an asterisk by that that simply says that that's a highly contentious statement. So if it's said matter of factly, it might be something that if people watching this, they may not be as nuanced as you. You know, they may sit there and say, well, yeah, it's a very scientific position. You go, well, it kind of depends on what you mean by that word. And it also depends on what you mean by, you know, and by the way, you know, to throw in the idea of environmental science and stuff to say, we're talking, what I used as my example where I said the overwhelming majority of people who are Catholic, mm-hmm. who have written about this in a Catholic sense, who've written about this in a Christian sense, who've written about it in a conservative sense, I would say the tides have turned on even within libertarianism that you see the number of people who are now just openly saying, look, I'm more Austro-libertarian than different strands of libertarianism, because there would be different strands of that. Mm-hmm. And so, but that one has a special place where the stuff they say of themselves. And so that's what I meant to bring up about that. But I want to say something about what you said earlier. You said that, you know, people can do things. It's kind of the Jordan Peterson thing where it's like, you know, people can do stuff and make their bed and it gets them moving. And that, and I do too. You're right to bring it up about depression, where I said, you go outside in the sun. You know, are you eating better? Are you trying keto? Are you eating sugar and stuff like that? Are you breathing and doing cold showers? All that stuff's really good. But I mean, we could say kind of the same thing. You used an example of apples and stuff. We could have used voyeurism or pimping, mm-hmm. and said a person's out there pimping every day and they're, look at the way they're flourishing. I think that's a wrong understanding of flourishing. I mean, and that's where the materialism creeps out. It's like, you know, the zipper's down, the materialism is showing. That it's like, it's not about the actual definition of what it would mean to flourish or be right or be anything like that. But instead, it's just being active and making some loot and feeling like, man, I'm getting up for the day. I get to, you know, whack this lady in the face because she's not making me enough money with the Johns. Like, that is not flourish. It's highly active,
but that wouldn't be permissible in libertarianism because you can't harm a person that doesn't like that.
So I'm just saying
that's to jump in the gun. Like, I mean, listen, again, is it a fact of psychology, as an example, that if somebody adopts a routine, it's better for them? It's just a fact.
Yeah.
Now, what you do with that routine has to be governed by what's moral and what's not. I think one of the disconnects here between Catholic social teaching, which, as annoying, this is the problem. The liberals have ruined all of these terms when we say things like living magisterium and the doctrine has evolved or something. These things, and I don't, not evolution in the sense of it changed, but the liberals have ruined an ability to talk about doctrine in a nuanced setting because it's all fluid for them. So we want to reject that. Whereas we do recognize, like, for example, I was reading a tweet from Eric Salmon, speaking of libertarians. He said, you know, he prefers Christ the King on whatever, a month ago, whenever it was. And he says, as many of the Novus Ordo movements of feasts might be annoying, there's nothing that's theologically reprehensible about it. That's true. Like, I don't reject the moving of feasts. I mean, All Hallows Eve used to be in May, right? And now it's in October. It is what it is. I mean, the Pope can make a prudential decision. It can be useful or not, but it's not necessarily reprehensible. The Pope's writing about economics, largely speaking, the majority of that is coming from the early 1900s and late 1800s. There was a problem that they were trying to address. And the problem they were trying to address was the Industrial Revolution, essentially, and its fallout. And we've had regimes. You have the American Revolution, you have the French, you have all these regime changes, and you have a new economic paradigm in a world that is more connected by industry than it was prior. So you have a new set of complexities that you have to try to deal with. But that world was still actually in many places not the case. There were many places that had not had electricity yet, for example, and then they did. And these things all matter because they vastly change the way that we live. And the thing is, by changing the material ways that we live, we do have to then approach various moral problems differently. For example, you know, we live around some Mennonites, and I just think, and heresy aside of Amishness, I think of the way of life that you would decide to live as someone who likes to live like that. There is morality baked into the cake. There's mortification. There's stoicism. There's suffering. I mean, just the fact that you decide to like not have hot water or something, or you know, not use electricity and, you know, have to go in the elements all the time. I mean, you build a certain level of rugged virtue just by virtue of being alive. And this is something that we see in the ancient cultures as well. I mean, it's not that material makes us virtuous, but there is a reality of living in the most rugged of sense by default necessitates a sort of virtue because we can't act completely selfishly because we'll die. I mean, there's a sort of a baseline thing there. So they're trying to deal with the radical change in this. I mean, if you look at the way someone lived at the time of the American Revolution, let's say in a settler territory in like the Dakotas or something. I don't know if they were there yet, but the point is they lived, that was probably in the 1800s. They lived more like someone in the year 1200 than they do like somebody in the year 1895 in New York City or London, England. That's the crazy part, the radical change. So the popes are trying to deal with this. Well, now we have data from these years past. We have 125, 30 years, whatever it is, since Pope Leo's first one. We have Quadragesimo Anno. And then we have John Paul II's. And we do see that these popes have made very insightful, nuanced positions about how social life ought to be organized, how we ought to deal with the modern state. You know, Father Murr, who I greatly respect, he said to me, they needed to make reforms to the Second Vatican Council. They just made them in the wrong direction. And there was this idea of the modern world that gets cringe when the liberals use it. Everything's modern world. But it's true. The modern world is different than the world before it. So how do you deal with it? So back to this Mises claim, though, about how the words of blessed be the poor has been used for things like socialism, etc. It just objectively has. This liberation theology, it's a wrong understanding on behalf of those people. But there's a reality there from a strictly neutral perspective at looking at how the various people in this world that is pluralist, which we cannot avoid, use the words of Christ to justify their evil means. And that sadly happens all the time. We're dealing with this right now under Pope Francis. You know, socialists love Pope Francis because they, you know, whether it's his intent or not, you know. So these things are just, and I got to go back to the science aspect here, though. Science means an ordered body of knowledge. That's essentially what it means. Anyone who spent a long time in a gym, for example, and knows a little bit of bro science, it's just a fact that you want to know about how to be healthy, lose weight, and be strong. You might want to go read a book. You might want to go talk to a physiotherapist. But to be honest, my experience, I've been a gym rat since I was 14 years old. It's almost 20 years now. I have never learned more than through the lived experience of the bro science experts. And I would say they're very scientific. Again, experts might disagree with them, but my lived experience of two decades tells me it's different. So people can debate on the science for sure. But that's, again, the point, is that it is an application of the scientific method, i.e. trying to experiment with things and see how they work out, which means as long as I don't cross any dogmatic lines, it's debatable and permissible. I think that's kind of the thing we have to admit.
Well, I think
let me just cut in real quick, Jeremiah, if I may, and then you can go.
You can cut in whenever you want.
Oh, thanks. I just want to say,
you have my permission, Tim.
I don't think anybody disagrees with you, Kennedy, that you know, we can take what is good from any philosopher whatsoever. But I have an issue when libertarians make comments like Christopher Dawson doesn't understand economics. Okay. Because there's sort of this assumption, that there is not there is actually a debate among the scientists, meaning the economists. Kennedy, would you concede that according to the science of Austrian economics, when you compare that with the best Catholic economists who are not Austrians, like Heinrich Pesch or whatever,
I think
Rupert Edwer, you know, they would disagree. They have a debate in their scientific field. Sure. Would you concede that
100%? And I would never, but I think Heinrich Pesch is fatally wrong in his assumptions. But I understand his Catholic principles. I just think they don't work in reality. And if I'm going to make a straw man here, people always like to say Heinrich Pesch's philosophy was used in the National Socialists. So that was people who advised the old mustache man, which is just a reality. Okay, so I agree. We can have debate on these things, but here's the thing that I find so frustrating about this. Seriously, I'm everyone knows me. I'm not gonna brag on my trad credibility here. I do apologize for the Society of St. Pius X, and I don't get paid for it. So clearly, I'm not trying to be some sort of I mean, go listen to my radio show. I did a 10-part series going through liberalism as a sin. But it's just so ironic in the traditional Catholic sphere. When it comes to economics, I will sit there and I will have people literally trying to show me why. And I can't stand using the word fascist in a sense of being, oh, he's a fascist. I know fascism is a legitimate philosophy. You know who is actually ironically extremely nuanced on fascism is one of the editors of Chronicles magazine, who says it's, and actually Mises was pro-Dollfuss and pro-Mussolini at the time, ironically. So that's a whole other story of people, the right-wing integralists needs to understand. But I will have people defend the most indefensible of regimes in the last 100 years because well, communism was really bad, so like this was justified. Or, well, you don't really understand what so-and-so was trying to do. And it's like, maybe I don't. And I'll grant you that you can defend the good parts of that, because you could find good things in Marx if you wanted to. Like every philosopher who says things that are just objectively true, if he's not a complete insane person. But there just seems to be no room amongst the traditional Catholics. There's like this knee-jerk reaction where I believe there are big blind spots amongst even the smartest of traditional Catholics against libertarian economics, Austrian economics. I believe that because we live in this time of this knee-jerk reaction towards modernism, which is the heresy, we conflate that with a knee-jerk reaction towards anything modern. Father Sherry, our district superior here, explains modernism does not mean modernity is bad. It just means this is a heresy that developed in modern times. Just like Americanism does not mean being an American patriot is wrong. It's a philosophy that developed in America. So the economic landscape, again, radically changed starting in the 15, 1600s. And we've been trying to play catch up ever since then. Heinrich Pesch's philosophy was predicated, for example, on a very strong national identity, which was necessary for that type of solidarism, how you pronounce it, to work. That does not exist anymore. That doesn't even exist in most places in Europe. So so libertarianism is the Austrian economic principle has tried to address, basically, they wouldn't say this because this is not how they conceive it, but this is how I see it. We live in a world that's post-Christendom. So now we have to contend with the fact that we live in a pluralist society. We have to contend with the fact that we are not putting the genie of modernity back in the bottle. So at this point, this is an approach to try to deal with it. I think the traditional Catholics, and you guys aren't doing this because you guys are obviously smarter than most people, especially you, Jeremiah. There's a blind spot though amongst a lot of traditional Catholics, like liberal. That sounds like liberalism. It's like it also sounds like the word liberty, which is just a word. I mean, distributed. That sounds like redistribution. Well, you're an idiot if you think that because you're misunderstanding Chesterton. So I think that the traditional Catholics need to also we have to be careful with our sacred cows. Christopher Dawson's amazing. When did Christopher Dawson die, Tim? 73 or something?
1970.
Okay, I was close. It's possible. This is just, and forgive me here for the sacred cow. It's possible that 1970, he had evidence up to 1970 of things that we did not see the logical conclusion of. And 40 years later, we could say, yeah, that didn't really work out the way they thought it would. And we could change and say, here's a reason to critique Dawson. So
that's fine.
Yeah. So all of these people may be right or maybe wrong on something, because again, these are matters of science in the truest sense of applying a hypothesis to lived reality and then seeing if it works or not. Hence, we can debate them.
I wanted to say a couple things. You know, one is that, you know, it would be a knee-jerk reaction if the church hadn't been talking about these exact same underlying philosophical presuppositions for over 150 years. You know, like it seems like in some ways when they talk about, for example, when they say we're living in a post-Christian world, radical individualism is run amok, you know, people are believing their own religion and spreading, you know, their freedom of speech and freedom of press all over the place and all that, you know, and no concept of truth. And you say it kind of sounds a little bit, it starts to feel a little bit like the person who started the fire is also the fireman now. And because if you go back and you look and you say, well, what do the popes talk about when they, what's the name of the school of thought that they refer to when talking about all this? Oh, that's right. That's liberalism. And they go through and they say, okay, so liberalism, and they lump in a whole bunch of things. It's not just free speech. It's not just freedom of press. It's not just freedom of conscience and freedom of religion. It's also anti-statism. It's also the idea, of course, that not just in the sense that the state shouldn't be involved, but maybe in fact that there shouldn't be a state at all, that you have these kind of ideas that take away from the majesty, in fact, of the state. And that over and over and over, as this develops over time, people have a lesser and hold in lesser and less esteem all the time the papal encyclicals and the commemoration of those things. And it gets to the point where even in Quadragesimo Anno, that to say that, you know, if they hold these things in little esteem, they either blaspheme what they know not, or they understand nothing of what they're only superficially acquainted with, or if they do understand, they convict themselves formally of injustice and ingratitude. And we're, you know, 100 years later, and you almost can't find a libertarian who, when talking about these encyclicals, it smacks. There's something, I think, in so many people's minds when they hear them talk about it, that it smacks of a lip service, because at the end of the day, they kind of play footsies about it and say, well, you know, they were wrong about this or wrong about that, but they're very particular with their cherry picking. Like they'll say, well, I really like what they say about private property in this one encyclical. And it's like, there's been a lot of encyclicals about this, or that the church doesn't have the, you know, they're going over, speaking beyond what they should, like what Tom Woods Jr. says in his, you know, unresolved tension kind of thing. And so when they hear that, and then they read the popes one after another, that say that we have the right and authority to bring under and subject to our supreme jurisdiction, not only social order, but economic activities themselves. When they read that, and they're like, well, it's kind of hard to square the circle. Like some, it's like that Sesame Street song, you know, where it's like one of these things just doesn't belong here. That one, it kind of starts to feel a little that way to a lot of people who read it and say, I don't know how you can say what the popes say and use the same words as libertarians do, but speak it with the meaning and understanding and application that the popes have consistently over and over and over, and say what libertarians are saying when using those same phrases. And I think that's at least being generous to the common reader who struggles grappling with that and saying it's unsurprising. The last thing I'll say is this right here. This plays right into what Kennedy was saying. I'm sorry I went so long with this.
How dare you, go on.
But right here, the ultimate consequences of the individualist spirit of economic life are those which you yourselves see and deplore. Free competition has destroyed itself. Economic dictatorship has supplanted the free market. Mm-hmm. Unbridled ambition for power has likewise succeeded greed for gain. Mm-hmm. All economic life has become tragically hard, inexorable and cruel. These have been added the grave evils that have resulted from intermingling and shameful confusion of the functions and duties of public authority with those of the economic sphere. And it says, such as one of the worst, the virtual degradation of the majesty of the state, which although it ought to sit on high like a queen and supreme arbitress, free from all partiality and intent upon the one common good and justice, is become a slave, surrendered and delivered to the passions and greed of men. That doesn't sound, I don't know many libertarians that would be able to echo that at all.
I agree with all of that.
How you could with the individualist spirit of economic life, it'd be fascinating to hear.
So it's not an individualist spirit. And as I've said, it's an observation of how individuals act economically. If somebody takes that to mean that they should act for themselves above all, then that person's an individualist. That's all. So as far as the majesty of the state, well, there's also, the Christ says, give unto Caesar, etc. So we give unto Caesar what we can without sinning. That's just basically how we've always understood that. You do what Caesar asks unless you sin. So it's also possible that you could live in a completely illegitimate state. Like, do you think that, for example, the popes would say, that the state of Saudi Arabia is a queen? I mean, they might say there's aspects of it that are naturally good because there are natural goods of order, etc. Fine. But I think they would probably say that that state is not run by a queen. It's probably run by somebody else. So we have to understand what is meant by state. That's one thing that we can talk about this in another episode. That would be a good topic, I think.
Yeah.
Because even in the New Catechism, I wrote an article back when I had a blog that nobody read before I decided to be canceled as a Catholic writer. I wrote an article about showing that Justin Trudeau was an illegitimate prime minister and ought not to be listened to. And I used the New Catechism, which I don't hate. 99% of it's great. It's wonderful catechism in many ways. And I used a bunch of citations, and I read it. I was like a neocon of this. I was listening to Ben Shapiro, for goodness sake. And I remember reading this and being like, Justin Trudeau has like no moral authority and ought not to be listened to at all in the eyes of the New Catechism. And that was easily demonstrable. I would not say that the state of Canada has any majesty to it. Also, there's no definition of what a state is supposed to be, because we could look back, for example, to the time of Alfred the Great. I'm talking about what you said, not in general, that doesn't exist. We could look back to, for example, the time of Alfred the Great. A state is the size of your average county, for goodness sake. There's like 30,000 people and there's a king. Totally possible that has majesty to it. But I would not say the state of China has any majesty to it today. So we have to understand the differences in states. And I will go back even more. I'll go back further and even go back biblical, because I think it's good to go back to the first principles. We know that God made nations. That's the Tower of Babel. Like, we are nations of people, and that is a revelatory fact. But those are not necessarily states. A state could include a nation, and it could include multiple nations in it. We saw this with the redrawing of borders after the First World War. Like, I mean, goodness gracious, the problem in the Middle East with places like Iraq and Iran, that is directly the faults of the majestic state of Britain, who made a state out of peoples that were not actually a state. So we have to make sure, we're sure that we're having nuances how we say these things. I agree with everything that you said about the conflation of individualism, etc. And I think by their fruits you shall know them. So if somebody is a true individualist, they usually end up becoming something like a collectivist, which is exactly true, which is why Ayn Randians can be so cringe, because there is no basis when you follow the ideas through all the way. So you end up becoming someone who basically becomes part of some sort of mob consciousness, which basically brings it in itself into collectivism one way or the other. But when you look at the fruits of the serious thinkers who were smart, and one more thing I'll say about encyclicals as well, I think it would be better off if most of us didn't read encyclicals, because when popes promulgate encyclicals, they don't do so with, unless they explicitly state, which is ironic because he explicitly stated in quo primum that this mass was to be used in perpetuity. But then again, the liberals will explain that away. But when they promulgate encyclicals, unless it's explicitly stated with certain type of language, like when Pope John Paul II put out Ordinatione Sacerdotalis, it was very clearly stated that this is an open and shut case because this is a matter of dogma. But when a pope puts out an encyclical about the state of affairs, it's not supposed to be taken that this will be binding in perpetuity if evidence suggests otherwise to the parts of this that are not dogmatic. That's just an implicit understanding we can have. If certain libertarians give lip service, okay, well, they give lip service. I can't speak for them. And also, that could be the perception of people that, for example, hold the teachings of various encyclicals very dear to their heart and get annoyed at the way other people talk about it. That's also possible. Last thing I'll say. We have evidence from the reign of Pope Pius XI that he was woefully wrong about a political reality. This is the case of Action Française. So Action Française was started by the philosopher Charles Maurras. That's me flexing my French pronunciation there. And he was an agnostic. He actually was a liberal, if you look at his metaphysics. What I mean by that is, and the integralists are going to lose their mind on me here, okay? I've read him in French. Get on my level, folks. So Charles Maurras was metaphysically actually a liberal. And what I mean by that, classic definition of liberal, he judged revelation by his own reason as the primary dictate. So he believed that France ought to be Catholic because Catholicism was good for France. He didn't believe France ought to be Catholic because France ought to be saved. So he actually had a reversed understanding of the place of Catholicism in society. His mentality could be used in a Jeffersonian way as well, that we should have the separation of church and state because that's good for the state. It was not about the religion. However, he was taught in the French seminary by Father Lefloche to people like Marcel Lefebvre and so on and so forth. And he was seen as the greatest political thinker, and it included economics in it, in France. The advisors to Pope Pius XI, who wrote Quadragesima Anno, advised him to suppress Action Française. And the reason being is because it started with liberal principles, and therefore it wouldn't be able to bear good fruit. They suppressed it. The Marxists took over France. That suppression was then reversed because it was realized that was a disaster. So the man who wrote Quadragesima Anno, because of his advisors, was woefully wrong on a prudential application of trying to reconcile social organization with Catholic dogma.
Yeah.
So
that, but that doesn't pose, but that doesn't pose a problem.
Exactly. I mean, you're right. It doesn't.
Well, no,
so he can be wrong, but it doesn't pose a, wrong. That's all.
But that, but he would be wrong only insofar as they admit in the encyclicals that they can be. Like, okay. And there's a distinction between that. Like they would say, we don't want to make a specific remark about a model of government per se, but the principles upon which those governments can even be based at all. And if, so, for example,
well, he did say that because he said it was that the first principles were wrong, therefore it was not a permissible movement.
But but he's saying, okay, so the idea though is still going after a particular organization, and maybe they could do the same thing with the Manchester the Manchester Liberals, right?
I think you're saying
maybe
that
one day.
Right? The encyclicals are kind of theory, whereas Anciens Français is practice. Is that what kind of word you're getting at here, Jeremiah?
Well, I'm saying that would be like them saying that they would endorse. I'm saying instead of coming against, let's say endorse a certain policy regarding minimum wage, for example, mm-hmm. right? The underlying assumption is that wages should not be left to purely so-called market forces. That it's like, well, that's the only. It's like a kind of a one-size-fits-all way of dealing with this. And they say, well, no. There's multiple factors that need to go in. There's multiple parties that need to be involved possibly in this because the main goal is to achieve X, Y, and Z. They praise multiple different techniques that have been put forward in that. But let's say they proposed one, right? Like League of Nations or the UN. Mm-hmm. The underlying idea is that international bodies being able to talk to each other to come to agreements contractually, that's good.
Yeah.
That particular institution, they may praise it or minimize it and be wrong about it, but that would not affect the underlying idea of the utility of it. And so what I'm saying is that libertarians have issues with the underlying notions, and we won't talk about it today, but that especially comes up in the idea about the state. What is the state?
The modern state.
Well, no, I mean the state at all. And so like my position would be that we'll talk about next week.
Yeah.
But to say that my argument here would be that the underlying assumptions, right, beneath the particular applications, that's where you see over and over and over on almost any one of these issues. And I labeled a bunch of them last week. People can go last week and find out. I listed off a whole range of things that the government is said that is the rightful interaction in economics. Right. And not only that it's rightful to get involved, but in fact that they have responsibility to get involved under the notion of the state as understood by the church. And on each one of those, I think we'd be hard pressed to find one Austro-libertarian who would agree with that. And so that would be my contention. Back.
So let's leave this till next week. We'll talk about the state next week. This has just been a good back and forth. And let's remember that we are up against the Marxist COVID regime together. So we're both in the foxhole debating this between the volleys of the enemy. So with that in mind,
that I love Kennedy Hall. I want to say this because there's people I've gotten emails, man. I've gotten emails from people that are like, dude, what are you doing? You know, and I'm like, for one, we were invited to talk about these topics. Number two, I'm like, and Kennedy can attest to this, right? And I don't like doing the behind the veil thing too often, but we've been messaging back and forth, right? Just mm-hmm. between the two of us, right? Mm-hmm. And I told you privately, even I'm like, I genuinely care about you, bro. Like as a man, as a father, I've told you,
cry,
I think
Jeremiah.
You're dude, I mean it like from my heart. And I said, you're the kind of guy, man, that we can disagree. Gloves can come off. We can do this thing. But at the end of the day, man, we're both at that kneeler. And yes, I will be kneeling. And we'll both be looking at each other, dude, nodding like this for communion. Okay.
There
like,
we go.
That's who we are because I'm with you, bro. So we can have these disagreements. I think it's good to have the octagon. But I don't want anybody watching this to walk away with it with the impression that I think less. Or that he thinks less of me, right? Because a lot of times when people watch debates like this and they say, man, these guys are talking tough, that they immediately think, well, maybe they're being uncharitable. And it's like, nah, dude, I love this guy. It's like the olden days. You go out and the boys are all around and they're boxing outside, right? Doing manly sport with each other. All right, buddy. And then they're hugging. And that's the way it is, and praying a rosary together, right? So that's, I just wanted to say that to make it abundantly clear to people that I have a great deal of admiration for Kennedy. Kennedy has taught me things. Yeah, I appreciate it, man, a lot. And I appreciate everything he does. And so I wanted to make that clear. I should have made it clear in the beginning, but it's okay at the end, man.
So. Yeah, original trifecta of Meaning of Catholic. This was back in the day, we debated Lefebvre like 2 years ago or something. So
just before 2 weeks to slow the spread.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So with that in mind, let's all go to the kneeler together and offer up a Pater Noster against the Marxists and for a just economy in whatever way we're trying to work that out, the best of our abilities and our piety. God give us grace and wisdom. In the name of the Patris et Filii Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Pater noster, qui es in caelis, sanctificetur nomen tuum, adveniat regnum tuum, fiat voluntas tua, sicut in caelo et in terra.
Panem nostrum quotidianum da nobis hodie, dimitti nobis debita nostra, sicut et nos dimittimus debitoribus nostris, et ne nos inducas in tentationem, sed libera nos a malo. Amen.
Amen.
Nomine Patris et Filii Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Amen. Jesus is King. Mm.